my name's Jack Dempsey, and I'm a drunk, not a fighter. Folks, I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee for bringing me down here. This is a really nice country. And my poor host, who compliments in Northwest Airlines, had to wait for me, I guess, at the airport 3 or 4 hours. I wasn't happy either. I guess all the things, if it was just about what you thought, they'd be on my amends list, but I'm going to wait for them to make amends to me. I got a story about me. You know, I'm an alcoholic, and I got my story. Now, when I first came into AA, I identified a lot with people, and there's a lot of people that come up to these podiums that I didn't identify with. And I know that some people really helped me back in those days, and some people didn't because they couldn't. My listener wasn't open far enough. Seems like every year my listener gets wider like a big funnel and lets more in there. You know, I can identify with almost anybody today. When I first came in, I could only identify with certain people. And now, if you can identify with me tonight, you're probably marginally psychotic. And just like everything else in AA, that's all right. You know? You just do what the man said earlier. You just keep coming back. I knew this would be a good crowd when I seen they got a laugh out of the 12 traditions. I felt, I just felt so safe and secure. I'm going to tell you this motley story. This you're here tonight. You people, you imagine, look at yourself, what you've done. You reached clean across the United States to the East Coast to bring a drunken plumber out here to tell you. Now, that's either stupidity or humility at its highest, you know. So I'm impressed, nevertheless, that you allowed me to come out here. But I was 18 or 19 years old, I guess, sitting drunk on a bar stool, figuring everything's so wrong and ratty that there's no sense of me going on. You know, I'm really a messed up guy and life is no good and this and that. And I contemplated why in those days. You know, I sat on that stool. I thought about what's wrong. Why am I like this? I come up with all the answers that I carried with me until I got done drinking and I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to change. But until that time, this is what I believed. I believed that I had a rotten home life. Now, we didn't even have dysfunctional families back then. But damn it, I had something going that was pretty good, though, I tell you. I had a working mother, and most mothers work outside the home today. Probably most of them do. In those days, they didn't, I guess, and most, it seemed to me that every other kid's mother stayed home and made pies and stuff for their kids. And their fathers would race home from work and rub their heads and spar with them and all that crap. And nobody rubbed my head. That's why my hair fell out. And I just had like a little chip about that on my shoulder. And my dad, my natural father, he was a professional bridegroom. He was married 5 times. He had 1 child, me, and he quit that. So I sort of took that personal, you know. And my grandmother sort of raised me because my mom worked. And my grandmother was odd. Really odd. She, God rest her soul, I loved her. I'm sure she loved me too. But she used to come out. We played on a street a lot. You know, we didn't have televisions, all that stuff. So we were outside. We played all kinds of games. We tortured cats and we tormented girls and we jumped over top of each other and we got hurt all the time and we just loved the hell out of it, you know. But we'd all be outside and my grandmother would come out there. She weighed about 300 pounds, and she'd waddle out there and get right up in front of everybody, all my peers, and give opinions about almost everything. And she'd get there undivided attention, you know, because she was such a presence. And then she'd blow her nose on her apron and go back in the house. And all my peers would make fun of her and make fun of me. And I was enraged with them, and I hated my grandmother for setting me up in this thing, and I hated them for being mean to my grandmother, and I just hated everything. It's just, oh, it's awful. And I think I got self-conscious in those days. Now, there's nothing in a big book about self-consciousness. It said that self-centeredness and selfishness, we think, are the root of our problem. And that's true. I feel it's true also. But self-centeredness is something else. Again, now self-centeredness, you could go around being good and be self-centered. I'll tell you what self-centered people do. They go into a Kmart or something that's pouring down rain, and they'll stand in the rain until the people who are standing in the doorway think on their own to get out of the way, you know, unless they're drunk and mad. Then they'll tell them, get the hell out of the way. But a person that's not self-centered would just go in there and stand right in the doorway and let you stand out in the rain because they, you know, notice things. You know, they're not self-conscious, you know. And I always hated people that weren't self-conscious. Because I'm all, excuse me, going through my whole life. Oh, I'm sorry, am I in your way? Here, I'll go sit in an alley. And I would, like, build that up. I would build up this saintlyhood of mine to the point that when I got drunk, it would all unravel. And then I'd frighten people because they expected me to be the same. They'd say, hello. I'd say, I'll kill you. Then I got dubbed as being as fruitcake, you know. And I had a hard time with that. So about the time I was 8 or 9 years old, my mother remarried. Excuse me. And I got a stepfather that was a cross between Archie Bunker and Adolf Hitler. And he made a hobby out of knocking the hell out of me, you know. And I didn't realize until after I was sober a couple years in AA that I made a hobby out of deserving it. I'm not saying it's right to go around beating kids, and I don't think much of that. But no matter what they do, you know, you can only beat them so far. You know, you might kill them, you know. So I don't condone that. But I know that I participated in my own problems a good deal. And there was no sharing back in them days. You know. We didn't share. And my stepfather, when he wasn't beating me, he was doing strange things. He was sort of a mentor for me to do strange things. And I took a lot of diversions. I'd done different strange things and some stranger things than what he did. But he was a good teacher. He used to come home. One time he came home with a bunch of chickens, live chickens. I'm a city boy. He told me I got to kill the chickens. Now, I liked chickens. But he told me how to kill them. So I said, I figured I'd get out of it with a dumb answer like, I don't know how to kill chickens. You know, I thought that would work, you know. I'll show you how to kill chickens, you know. So he takes me down a saw and he gets a block of wood. He drives two nails in that block and he stretches a chicken's head and he chops the head off. He's got these man hands. He's holding that chicken there without a head on it. It's just moving a little bit like that. See that, boy? He sticks it in a box, and his wings are going in the box, you know, but it's in the box. That's how you do that. He goes to bed, and he leaves me down there. Now, I'm just, oh, this is a trauma. Like I said, I don't have anybody to share with, you know. So I'm pacing around down there in the cellar, how the hell I'm going to do this? The chickens are looking up at me, you know, blinking their little eyes and stuff, you know. So finally I know I got to do it, and I grab one of the chickens, and I stretch its head across there. I chop its head off. Now I got these little boy hands, little cute little boy hands, maybe even on the feminine side a little bit, you know. And I try to pick, that chicken's gone, man. I'm going to tell you something about chickens if you cut their heads, if you don't know nothing about that, you know. When you cut a chicken's head, they ain't done nothing their whole life except go like this, you know. You chop their head off, they become an eagle. And that chicken, like, elevates above me, it seemed. Blood's coming down on me. This is the most disgusting thing that could ever happen to you, I thought at the time. Just disgusting. And I became angry. The next chicken, I get that chicken out of there, and I don't care whether I hit his head with the wrong end of the hatchet. Don't care. And then I have this, like a chill comes through me, and I'm thinking thoughts like, what the hell am I, an apprentice serial killer or what? Is this how this starts? And again, no one to share with. You know, after this incident here with the chickens and all, meanwhile, I'm not doing good in school. You know, I don't like school. I don't want to learn what they teach you. You know, I mean, they teach you stupid stuff. They teach you what the capital of all the states are, or something like that. You know, I probably wasn't listening. I just heard today, under my host told me, this is the capital of California. But I don't know him well enough. He might have been lying. What the hell? You can believe a teacher, but you can't believe an AA host right on the top of there, you know. I'll have to investigate a little bit. But that's the kind of stuff they were teaching me in grade school. The things I wanted to know were, do patent leather shoes really reflect up? That's one of the things that I wanted to know why you could not stick a cat's tail in a light socket. And I thought people were looking after me, that they thought maybe I'd get shot through the cat, you know, but I didn't know they were concerned about the cat. They weren't concerned about chickens, now they're all upset about cats. You know. What the hell's this world coming to, you know? So, I was a mess, and by the time I got into junior high school, I was a bad boy. Bad boy. I lived in sort of a suburb of Pittsburgh at that time. It was ratty enough to be considered Pittsburgh, but it was sort of a suburb. And I was in a boy and girl school, regular nice school, you know. And I was forging library passes and selling them and selling dirty pictures. Kind of dirty pictures I was selling you could see on national TV now, you know. I was 40, 50 years ahead of my time, you know. But I was in trouble all the time for that, and I needed money to buy cigarettes, you know, and so I had to have the money. Everybody's always after them smokers. Ain't that something? Shit, I can't believe it. I stopped smoking because I might die if I smoke. So I quit. That's a good reason. If you're smoking and you're pretty sure you're going to die, quit. But don't listen to these other son of a bitches who are just trying to make the few cigarettes you got left feel good, you know? To hell with them. That's a good habit to take as far as you can and then quit. That's all I got to say about that. These people were so secondhand smoke oriented out of here that they damned us out in the East with that catalytic converter. What you guys got to do is invent a cardiac converter for all the non-smokers to wear so they're not affected by this goddamn smoke, you know? I just love to smell a cigarette smoke in the morning, just like napalm, you know. Enough of that. This is about alcohol, right? I was having a hell of a time at school. Finally, this little school, the borough that I was in, they paid the city of Pittsburgh, Goodhart, Swissville was the name of the town, Swissville money, to take me down there to Pittsburgh and put me in a vocational high school, which was called Conley Vocational High School. It's right in the center of the very worst section of Pittsburgh. They just put it right there. We got cat houses on one side and drug dens on the other, and that high school was just shining there in the middle, you know. It's where they taught everybody trades. They teach you plumbing and carpentry and all this and that. And they teach you how to get in front of somebody's sink and let the crack of your ass stick out. That's where we learn all this stuff. And they teach you how to play the dozens, how to fist fight, and how to play dirty, and how to try and sneak through school without getting caught, and how to shoot pool and get out of school and drink wine and all that stuff. That's what I did. I went down there. And I didn't like it down there. I didn't have many friends down there. We had no racial problems down here. Everybody hated each other equally. It didn't matter what color you were, what nationality or church, it didn't matter. Everybody was mean to everybody, and it was working. You know. But I hated it down there. So what I did was I didn't want to study because I hated school yet. That didn't change. I liked plumbing shop. I mean, you know, I want to point out, maybe I don't have to here, that I was afraid to talk around home and say that I was terrible in school when I went, you know, went to plumbing school. You know, they won't hire me, you know. But I could confess out here that I made decent grades in plumbing. It was the only one. And I, you know, like it leaped out, I'd get a B or an A in plumbing and the rest of them would be red, you know, and it would get the old man's attention, you know, so I didn't want that. So I got free report cards. I got brand new report cards off of a friend in print shop. He made these. And I'd swap him dirty pictures or whatever for them. And one day I got an exceptionally bad report card, and this kid was in juvenile court or something, and he wasn't there, and I couldn't get no cards. See, you couldn't store them cards because they had periodic locker searches, and they just didn't trust us. They weren't trusting. And so I didn't have any report cards. So I had this bad report card, and I took it home. I'm probably 15 years old. And the old man wasn't home. He was still at work. And I'm waiting for him. I'm pacing the house waiting for him. Because I know I already did something else terrible. You know, I left his favorite paintbrush get hard or some damn thing. And I knew this report card, combined with him finding out that I'd been duping him all this time, forging these things, it was bound to all come out now. It was a horrendous scandal for me, you know. And I knew this time it was going to be a capital offense. I knew it. And so I'm waiting to die, really. And I'm pacing the house, and I found sloe gin in the icebox. And I drank it. Now, everything that I've been whining and crying about for 20 minutes went away when I drank that. It all went away. And I spent the next 14 or 15 years explaining to them, whoever the hell they are, why I drink. I tell them, you know what, when I'm not drinking, I want to kill myself. And I want to kill you. And I don't want to frighten you, but that's how I feel when I'm not drinking. And when I drink, I feel wonderful. What part of that don't you get? You know? Why do you drink? Why do you drink? Why do you drink like that? Like what? Like out in my porch in the middle of the night. Like, why do you drink like that and then stand up on my table and pinch my wife's ass and all that stuff? Well, it's not really the drinking that you're concerned about, is it? You know? So, I started drinking. That's how I got started drinking. You know, you got started drinking one way, I got started drinking that way. We all get started drinking some kind of. You find out, the one thing that's frightening to accept, it was for me, that this stuff is the medicine I need to do my life. It's what I found out, that's what I need to do my life. I didn't only thought that, I knew it. I knew that alcohol somehow had to be managed. It was like if the only thing to ride was a tiger and you had to ride, you're going to try to figure out a way to get on that SOB, you know. You got to put tuck tape over his claws, or you got to do some damn thing, but the only way to get there is on that tiger, and you got to ride it. You better do some damn fast shuffling and thinking to try to figure out how to do it, you know. You can might just grab his tail and pull you, you know. He'll probably pull you in circles, you know, but you got to do other crazy things, like get some carrot on a string way out there so the tiger will drag you in a straight line. But you, as long as you're dealing with that tiger, your life's dominated by that tiger. That's simply my story. The alcohol was my tiger, man, and it was dominating my life. But I knew damn well there had to be, if there was a God, he was going to show me some kind of way to harness this damn tiger. Because other people seem to be doing it. Because I seen the whole picture. I'm looking out there and I'm looking at social drinkers and thinking that I'm like them. You know, I didn't know. They fake you out. Because social drinkers do a lot of stuff alcoholics do. They'll slide out there and cheat on their wife, them sons of bitches. You know? They'll get drunk one night and wreck their car. So they're like spies. They infiltrate the alcoholic. The alcoholic like me that wants to cheat on his wife, but wets his pants while he's in the middle of a conversation with some chick. You know? So a lot of guys like me just don't weather as well, you know? And I was having a hell of a time. And I was trying to manage all in the early years of my drinking. It was like a quest to do something about it. Well, I got married, you know, I was 18 years old. You know. I was in love. And I was 16 or 17 when I fell in love with this girl. A 17-year-old boy in love. Can you imagine that? A 17-year-old boy is a hormone. Like Tina Turner says, what's love got to do with it? What is that? Somebody say it's love. Yeah, okay. Okay, it's love. Turn me loose. What's she want to hear? Whatever. How many nice things do I got to say? Let's see. It's 15 minutes. Go ahead. You're beautiful. I love you. You've got some smooth skin. I think the world of you. Yeah, I'll call you every night. Yeah. Come on. You know. So that's what I was. My wife, I'm still married. Same woman. 43 years. She, thank you. My wife's an Al-Anon seal out in Pittsburgh. But my wife has beautiful legs still yet, and them legs of hers, that's all I seen for maybe 2 years. After 2 years, she told me her eyes were green. Look at my eyes. Look. It was so embarrassing to watch my wife's thoughts and dreams shattered by her incapacity to understand how self-centered I was. I mean, I was so self-centered that she couldn't believe it for a long time. She just thought there must be some mistake in what he said or what he did. He couldn't be that selfish. It's just impossible for any son of a bitch to be that bad, you know. And I wasn't evil. I was just selfish. And that's what tricked her, you know. She expected to see somebody like Adolf Eichmann. If they're going to be that bad, you know, they got to be like that. They couldn't be like him. He's nice in his respect and sit there and play with a dog or something or do something nice. But then on the other hand, whatever he wanted, he's gone. And that's the way it was. As time went on, you know, that takes that edge of that kind of crap keeps getting fouled down as you get older. I'm sure it's not all the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's fine-tuned me a little bit. It's like getting so damn old, you just can't get in as much trouble. You know, it's certain how your back feels sometimes gets in the way of some of your progress when you get 61 years old. You know, and then there's temptation's not bad. You know, the 61-year-old bald-headed fat guy just don't have that much trouble with other women. And I could say, oh, that's because of me, because of my fine program, my altruistic views these days and all that shit. You know, I ain't going to say that. So anyhow, I'm drinking and my wife's not liking it. And she's in the campaign of stopping this drinking, and I'm in the campaign of trying to drink right. Trying to drink some kind of way that will work without all this side problems. And it's not working. I needed a higher power back in those days, and I found one, Beneficial Finance Company. You know, and they helped me out of a lot of jams, and they told me that I could have money anytime I wanted, and they said that I could borrow it confidentially, and they lied. If you don't pay it, they'll tell anybody they have to. You know. And I just hated the way that they operate, because they operated so business-like, you know. And all during my, when I come in AA, I remember hearing a lot of guys talk about the alcoholic lying, you know, like we lie a lot, you know. And that's a bad thing. You know, that's not a bad thing. If you're going to drink, you got to lie. Or you can't drink. How the hell can you drink without lying, you know? I mean, you can't go through this explanation to every jackass that asks you, why do you drink?
Can you tell me why you're drinking?
You know? Tell them some damn thing, you know? I'm drinking because I'm worried about you. You're on fire, for Christ's sake. Whatever it takes to get them off your back, just get them the hell out of there, you know. So, I went to Beneficial Finance Company and I would get money, and they would ask me, why do you want the money? Why do you want this money, sir? You know, well, why? You know, I tell them the truth, tell them, well, I've been drinking, gambling, and carousing for 2 weeks, and I'm broke. Now, that's the truth, you know. Truth will set you free. It'll set you free without the loan. So you tell them you want to buy a new iron lung for your mother. Same with the cop stop me. You know, a cop would stop me and say to me, how many drinks do you have? I said, well, I probably had too many, officer. I would say that in any case. But he would say, why are you driving drunk like this, you know, if he asked me that? I'd say, well, officer, I don't drink, really. But today, just this morning, I found out that my blind son graduated from medical school. You know? I'm sure you couldn't tell that to a California cop, you know. Not them ones we hear about in television. Are they all down in Los Angeles? I don't know. Boy, Pittsburgh, they started looking at the Pittsburgh police over this California. We're not shining either, boy. We're getting our ass in a lot of trouble out there. You know, I'm glad I'm not out there drinking, you know. Cops in Pittsburgh, they'll kill you for gawking at them, you know. But they're nervous and upset now because they're all getting sued and chased and hearings and jail and threatened. Oh, my God. We got to get almost everybody in AA. It's the only solution. It's a nice fantasy. It's a beautiful fantasy. And but anyhow, my wife, meantime, you know, the chaos that goes on with the drinking. You know, it's just like, I like sort of like an Archie Bunker household I'm living in. You know, I'm a blue-collar working guy, and you know, and I'm busting coffee tables, and I'm punching holes in the wall. I had an interesting thought come to me after I got newly sober. I started doing stuff around the house after I got sober. I bought a house, and I put a game room in, you know, and I'm driving nails in that wall. I must drive 20 nails looking for a stud, you know. When I was drinking, I'd catch a stud the first whack. And you'd be in so much pain, you could hardly think good enough to move over, you know, move over 8 inches. It's got to be here, you know. And I'm throwing furniture, busting that up, and I'm frightening the children and making the neighbors mad and blah, blah, and on, you know. But I didn't seem to have any control over that. I mean, I'm not excusing it, but somebody would always pump me up. You know, it's nobody would ever learn their lesson. Like, I could not learn my lesson. I was addicted to alcohol, and I could not learn. Because one thing, I knew, I didn't know what else I could do about it. If I thought I could do anything about it, I would have done something. I just couldn't. I tried all the time to do something about this drinking problem. The problem part of the drinking was to other people, was the good part. You know, when I was drunk and happy and sitting at the kitchen table wetting my pants, they thought it was a problem. I didn't think that was a problem. It was a problem when you were going out of your way to scream and holler at me for hours on end. Nag, holler, bitch, and complain. Jesus, shut up! You know? And then I would do martyrish things like, in order. You know, I remember one time getting in my car. I had a lousy car. All my cars were alcoholic cars, you know? Windshield wiper won't work on a driver's side. You have to crawl out the window to get out the door. Headlights, one of them's dangling down. I got 4 different sized tires on the car. 3 of them are bald, you know. It ain't paid for. It burns oil. You have to start it with a penny. You put a match cover on a penny and touch something. I just forget. That's the kind of car I had. And I had everything like that in my life. Everything. I had one suit she bought me in case I hopefully if I die, you know. And I played drums in those days. I was playing drums in blues joints and that, working in the mill, too. My wife would wake me up. I didn't know where I was supposed to go. I'd wake up, be dark in the wintertime. You don't know whether it's night or morning or what the hell it is. You wake up off a drunk, and she'd wake me up with a mop handle. Get out of there. Get up. What? You know, she'd have to go to work. Where? I don't know whether I had a band job. I was praying. I'd say, oh, God, be a band job. I'd get out of here, go to the bar, get a couple whiskeys, man. No, you're going in a mill. You're on third shift, don't you know it, jackass? You know, I'd have to go in a mill, and boy, they'd go in there, man. 5 degrees outside, freezing your ass off, and put you in there. You're up on them top of them furnaces. I'm trying to fix something up above them, and my ass is on fire. My nose is froze. Oh, what a job in them steel mills. Jesus. What do you say to people? You know, people go around, some of the yuppie people go around saying, well, those mills were no good anyhow. There's bad smoke coming out of there. And us, my children breathing it, you know. And anybody could do that job, you know. Just take them out of the steel mill and put them in Wendy's, you know. Jesus. That ain't the stupidest goddamn thing I ever heard of. Guys in there knew their jobs. They knew how to make steel and it. Complicated, damn heavy machinery, and it was hell on wheels, man. And you got in there, you got a fever for it. You know, you worked in them mills. I remember that, boy. Them guys would grab the new guys and just somebody grab your arm, pull you out of the way, and you didn't even know why. And this big ingot come down right beside. That's why I pulled you out of there, so that when somebody wouldn't come down on your head, you know. You're saying bells ringing, whistles going, fire flying every way, saying, oh boy, I'm making big money, you know. More than I deserve. I know them steelworkers shouldn't make any money because they're just dumb hunkies from Pittsburgh. You know? Boy, am I getting sidetracked. Holy shit. Anyhow, my wife's dragging clergy in and out of the house trying to fix me, and I'm trying to read, too. I'm reading all these self-improvement books in my conscious moments. I'm reading. And I like to read, you know. You'd think I'd utilize that in school, but I never liked what they want me to read. So I read all this other stuff. I remember Maxwell Maltz's Psycho-Cybernetics. The last book I read when I came in AA and along that line was I'm Okay, You're Not Okay. And prior to that, I read all that stuff. You know, if it had some kind of thing on it, or anything to do with psychology or growing up absurd and all that. Looking back at all the books I read, I remember seeing pieces in the paper since I got sober in magazines, and about almost 90% of the authors of all the stuff I read died of drugs, or they were hauled off in a net or some other goddamn thing. A lot of them from out this way, boy, they really got out here. You know. Jesus, they just gravitated. Anybody that could stay sober long enough to get on a damn bus in Pittsburgh that was completely nuts, come out here. All my friends come out here. Most of them are dead, but they come out here first, you know. Looking for the new life, the new frontier. California, they came. I would have been here, too, but I couldn't get here. You know? I get as far as Chicago, and my ass would fall off, you know. And I go back, because Chicago was just like Pittsburgh, only bigger. And I had enough fun in Chicago that I had to go back home and get healed. Figure next time maybe I'll go past Chicago, go around it, and I can get all the way to California. That never happened, you know. I got a brother, we shot him off like a slingshot. He ended up in Hawaii. Now he can't get back. Not that I miss him that much, but I mean, he's out there in Hawaii where he can't hurt nobody, you know. They got the, they all run out in the water. I guess he's afraid to swim, you know. But he, God rest his soul. Anyhow, I couldn't get sober that way. My wife drugged me to a psychiatrist. He couldn't sober me up neither. He told me he thought I was a latent something. I lamb blasted that son of a gun. I think he was just trying to shake me up, you know. I was more of a homophobic than anything else. But I found out after I got, you know, I'm not like that anymore. You know, I don't give a damn what you do. Just don't get any on me, that's all. But I figure this way, everybody's doing what they want to do. You know, you get, after you're married 43 years, you know, I heard a speaker talk. He says, there's only thing about it. He said he had a lot of trouble with the sex part, you know, which the big book devotes about a half a page to. It's on page 69, by the way. You don't think alcoholics were involved in writing that book. Of course, I'm so damn cynical, you can't trust me any more than you can that host over there. You know? But what the hell was I talking about? Jeez, I get really sidetracked out here. It must be the weather out here or something. But, damn, I can't remember at all. Jesus, I'm not going to elaborate on that. But anyhow, what the guy said was, he says the only thing, the only answer to this, is an old-time AA guy. He's probably from down where Bill Stockton, he's from Georgia and down that area. And I just love them good old boys down there. Their humor is so great, and they're so subtle and sort of laid back, you know. And he said, the only thing about sex is, you're either getting it or you ain't. He said, if you're getting it, goddamn it, be grateful and act like it. He said, if you ain't getting it, you're not doing your program right. So there you are. Another simplistic AA answer that just baffles all the bullshitters. You know? You almost got to be nice. All them things that I found out about, you know, that people told me about when I was a young kid in reference to how to treat my girlfriend, still apply. I thought those things would go away with time. Like gravity would go away, you know. Certain things don't go away, that's all. And I'm starting to accept things. Maybe by the time I'm completely accepting in all matters, I'll have another 2 minutes to live or something. So that's pretty much the way I've been doing it. But I ended up, you know, with all this crap would happen to me, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what will happen to you if you don't watch. You come here all kinds of ways. Somebody drag you here. Somebody recommend it. Catch you in a weak moment when you say, yes, maybe I should, you know. But you'll come past this thing if you don't die. If you die, like that first thing I mentioned, you don't have nothing to worry about. You just die. It don't matter whether you come here or not, right? You'd be fine. But if you don't die and you come here, then lots of stuff's going to happen. I come here in January 1969. Now, I didn't get sober till April the 18th, 1970. That's when I had my last drink, see? But all those 14 or 15 months, my home group used to call me Jack the Slipper. And I did not like that because I tried to do this program as best I could. It just wasn't enough. I couldn't do it any better than what I was doing. And looking back on it, I didn't do anything wrong. I'd done everything that I do. As an active alcoholic and as a guy that had the pain I had and the problems I had and the way I felt, I did the best I could do. And so here I am. But I didn't get drunk on account of that first step. I used to get drunk and I'd come to a meeting and people would tell me, you didn't get the first step. What's the matter with you? God damn it. Do the first step. And I start talking about other things, you know, all these deep-seated resentments and stuff and get off in never-never land. They tell me, you don't have the first step, that's all. Now, looking back on it, I think I was right about that. It wasn't the first step, you know. I had the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives would become unmanageable. I had that step. But I was powerless over alcohol. My contention is, if you're powerless over alcohol, you're going to drink. If you don't get over, have something happen to you that makes you get over being powerless over alcohol, you're going to drink. That's the difference between me and a social drinker. I'm powerless over alcohol, so I could stand around and not drink. I'm not drinking. Damn it. I'm not drinking. I'm not drinking. I could just not drink the hell out of you, you know? Someday, somewhere, something's going to happen and I'm going to drink because I'm powerless over it. Because the booze is back here. Come on, hell with them. Come on, you know, because you think of only the good stuff about drinking when the pressure and the heat's on. People are up your hind end. You know, you say, oh, man, some blues joint, jukebox perking, man, get down Joe Cocker on there or something. You can leave your hat on, baby. God damn it, I want out of here. You know? And you go, if you're like me. Or somebody does something, and that's how it happened to me. I always drink. At 4 months of my wife being my boss, and I drink. Not just her. She's not the only thing. My boss at work, I hated him, too, because he didn't think I was sober. After all, I got in AA, was in AA, and he'd come over and smell me. And I hated him for doing that, and I'd go home, and my wife would be mad because I didn't cut the grass, you know. And I'd tell her things like, yeah, I'd be glad I'm not smoking it anyhow, you know. But, you know, in those days, I didn't have a lot of things happen yet. What the promise AA made to me was to turn my, you know, if I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me sanity. The second step was my problem, see. If I could have got the second step at that time, I might have not slipped. But that's, you know, that's a moot point because I'm looking back, it's already happened. But I'm looking at what happened in my case. But I wasn't, there was a lot of things to come my way. A lot of the promises in AA come to me as I went along. As long as I kept staying sober and kept coming to meetings, the promises happened. See, there was attitude changes that had to happen to me that I didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't know that I didn't think that that house was mine. I didn't cut my own grass because it was her grass. That's why. And that's so stupid and simple. You'd wonder why in the hell I wouldn't figure that out. But that was, it was her kids, her, everything good was hers. If we had $2 in the bank, that was on account of her. Not me, because I spent everything. If I did get any money together, I went out and bought another car, you know, family car, like a convertible or something. And she didn't do that. She took care of the house, she took care of the bills, she took care of listening, taking the heat off utility companies or the bullshit from finance companies calling for their money. She did all that. So all the serious, goodly, worthy, constructive things that went on anywhere near my life was done by others. And so nothing was mine. The only thing was mine was that wreck of a car I had outside, that suit with a hole in it, the couple pair of jeans and a zipper was broke in. That's about it. And 4 or 5 mismatched socks, you know. That was mine. And but I didn't know that that house was mine. I didn't know that. I didn't feel that. If somebody could have told me, I would have said yes. Whose house? Yes, yeah, my house. But I didn't feel it. So I couldn't do things. But I didn't, that was to come. That was to come by doing what AA told me. Now, who saved me? Who fixed me? Who done this? I mean, God did it. But how did God do it? For me. God put me in with people that really helped me. And almost everybody in AA stands up at the podium and they say wonderful things about old timers. Those old timers, you know, they done this. The old timers could not help me. I made myself unavailable to the old timers. The guys that did help me are a lot of kind of guys that are sitting out here tonight. You're sober a year, 6 months, 8 months. You're the guys that helped me, and I tell you how. I'd go into an AA meeting, and I'd be bitching and moaning to some old-timer in there, and he'd be saying things to me like, ah, easy does it, Jack. Have a coffee, you know. And sit down, you know. And that was not helping me, and I'm snarling, and I'm getting my coffee. God damn him. And these other guys that are sober 8 months or a year, they would laugh at me. You'll be drunk by Wednesday. I said, what the hell you mean? I'm just, how long are you sober? I'm sober 8 months, goddammit. I say, well, how long are you going to stay sober? I'm staying sober today, buddy. And if you want to stay sober today, maybe you'll come with us. I don't want to go with you. There you are. It's Wednesday for him, right, Charlie? You know. I said, okay, where are you going? He said, we'll pick you up. And here's Charlie. Charlie is the king or the boss of this car. He's the guru. He's sober a little over a year. He finally got his car out of the pound or something. He got his insurance reinstated or something. So he's driving. It's his vehicle. And you go to the meetings he wants to go, and he has a sidekick, George. It says pigeon. And he, George, is sober about 6 months. And George stayed sober by saying, yeah, Chuck, that's right, Chuck. You're right, Chuck. Now, I tried to get in the front seat of that car where this George sits, you know. And Chuck said, no, 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 no. You sit in the back. He said, that's George's seat there. You know? Oh. Well, I look in the back, and there's a couple guys in there I don't like. One guy in particular is a guy who went down to one of these AA clubhouses. He's sober the same amount of time as me, a month. And he won a television set. Now, I needed a goddamn television set. And I knew that if I brought a television set home, I could bypass all this amends bullshit with my wife and go right in the sack without all that shit. But he wins the TV, so I don't like him. And the guy tells me to go sit with him. So I told the guy, I says, you know what, I don't like him. He said, you know what, Jack, he don't like you neither. He said, he just told me that yesterday. He said, go sit back here with him. He said, maybe that'll all change. It'll be like an AA miracle, you know. So I get back in there with the guy. Now, we'd go to these meetings, and all these meetings I didn't want to go to. I mean, they got a meeting 6 blocks down the street. These guys would drive for an hour and a half to go to some meeting somewhere where some guy's there. Old Clarence is there or something like that. I want to go up to Charleroi, so I want to see old Clarence. You know, I never seen Clarence, and I never even want to go to Charleroi. I had vague recollections of getting in front of a magistrate up there one time, but that was it. They want me to go up there, and I mean, but you'd go up to this meeting, like in Charleroi, wherever it was, and there'd be this guy. Now, I didn't want what he had. He had one tooth here. He had a big belly. He's about 50, 55 years old, and I don't want what he has. But these guys all did want what he had. I didn't know what he had in those days. I found out later what he had. When I walked in with those guys, this Clarence would say, hey, George, did your wife get that job she was looking for? He'd say, this other guy said, hey, do you go over to that meeting and such and see that woman lead I was telling you about? And they didn't have this rapport going on. And this guy was out of himself, this Clarence guy. This guy was... He knew these guys. He knew their names. He knew their little stories, their lives and all that. He wasn't into himself, and that's what they liked about Clarence, and I didn't see it. I wanted to go hang around the hotshot guys that had something funny to say, something nice, you know, and something that would get me going. I had a vision of success in AA would put me in a big car and a nice home and surround sound. I wouldn't even have surround sound. But I didn't see it because I was spiritually unable to see what they seen. I knew they had something, but I didn't know what the hell it was. It's not a thinking thing for anybody that's new enough out there to think that, God, I got to be smart enough to be able to see what the hell goes on here. It's not about smart. It ain't about that because I never got this damn thing was about smart. I'm just not smart enough. But there's people who think it's about smart that are chasing their tail because it's not about smart. It's about your gut feeling. It's about changing the attitude in here. And that attitude gets changed by others. You know, it's not your doing. I mean, you can practice doing a lot of good things and maybe some of them will catch on. But it's about getting it. It's about it coming to you. Allow God to give it to you. That's what I think it's about. But these guys would get in the car. Now, we'd get down the road. And these conversations would go on in that car, you know. One guy would say, you know what, Chuck, I didn't go to that meeting Tuesday that you and I were talking about, and I'm going to tell you why. Chuck said, yeah, why? He said, well, because, you know what, Sally's leaving me. God damn, I ain't going to make this program. I know it. I love her so much, and she's leaving me, and I don't know what I'm going to do. This other guy would say, hey, I can't make this program if I'm stuck with that Helen anymore. Why don't you take her? And everybody else in the car would laugh, except the offended ones. See? And these stories would race around that car like that, these different problems, these different traumas that would pop up in everybody's life. And they'd all laugh, and once it'd go so fast around there sometimes, and you'd end up laughing at your own shit. I couldn't wait. In the beginning, I couldn't wait to tell them guys how mean my wife was. I mean, it was like, to me, it was shocking how barbaric she was with me. It was just unbelievable how somebody could be just such a shrew as she was. She, you know, I thought, I think she's back to starching my shorts again, too. Just doing terrible things to me, you know. And I'd have that, plus the boss, and my job's in jeopardy. I don't have any money. Finance company is bothering her, so she's becoming a goddamn screaming banshee by the time I get home from work. And my whole life's upset. My kids got stomach problems now, and then a damn doctor told my wife that it's on account of nerves, and that's on account of me. He might as well say that's on account of Jack, you know, to her. And, Jesus, I dump all his troubles in the car, and they all laugh, you know. And so I used to like to have a bigger package. The bigger package of shit I had, the harder they'd laugh, you know. Excuse me, that's sort of sick. But it was working. And it got to be like, I liked bad stuff to happen to me. So I'd have more to say, because any of the people that laughed at my crap, and then I am laughing too. I realized one day, I wasn't sitting in some little quiet chapel with the sun streaming through stained glass window when the second step happened for me, you know. I'm sitting on the toilet waiting for them guys to pick me up. And I realized that I wanted to be with them more than I wanted anything else in the world. And funny looking beat up first year AA guys in their crummy smoke-filled car, going to a stinking meeting in a bad part of town on a Wednesday night or something. And I wanted to be with them. I wanted to be with them. The camaraderie with those guys was more important to me than anything else in this world. And I realized that I believed that a power greater than myself was going to fix this problem. I believed it. I absolutely believed it inside. So I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. It wasn't Mahatma Gandhi that came to believe, or Billy Graham, or Pope John, or anybody. It was Jack Dempsey, a stinking plumber from Pittsburgh, that came to believe that a power greater than myself could fix me. Restore me to sanity, they say. I look back on it as fix me, because I've stayed. My insanity was to drink anyhow. That was my insanity. Drink anyhow, that's true insanity for me. It's not insanity to jump up on a table at a party with a lampshade on your head. That's not insanity. It's not insanity to put a pig in a cop's car and run. It's insanity to drink anyhow. You know, to drink when you know what booze does to you, to drink and go down the chute even further, because there is nothing, when I'm drinking, there is nothing. Like that psychiatrist told me that he thought I was a latent something, brother. I looked in that big book, I read that book, and I see, it tells us in there that somebody that would contemplate or go back out drinking would experience incomprehensible demoralization. Now, that's not wearing a lampshade on your head at a party. Incomprehensible demoralization. So I'm a late in everything. I can't imagine if I kept drinking and continued to drink where I wouldn't go. I would either go to the very dregs for money, or just to shock somebody into helping me, or shock somebody into getting out of my life. I would do anything. I drank with a guy one time that said he was on a boat with some people, sort of upscale people, and he was sort of like brought along for the hell of it. And he got drinking. He got a fish, and he said something. Somebody, he was drunk, and somebody said to him on a boat, you're going to cook that fish, jokingly, you know. And he was just drunk enough, he took a bite out of that live fish, you know. And I could see myself doing something like that. Because, I mean, I didn't do that particular thing, but I thought, you know what, I could handle that. And if I had any reason when I was drinking to do anything, I'd do anything. I'd rob something. I knew that. I had no compunction. I would do that, you know. I guess I'm not only a marginal psychopath, but a marginal sociopath. You know, I don't know. I don't think so, because I have love in my heart. And And I found it in here. That little wee seed of love that was inside me, this place just pulled it out, man, and let it grow. But I found something here that would help me. I found something here that would make me able to go through life and live life. And not only did I just make it, all I really prayed for was to try and make it, to try to get this monkey off my back, get this terrible compulsion out of my life so that I could function. But instead, I got the world. I got everything. I got two kids. My daughter. It took me 3 or 4 years to make amends to my family, to my satisfaction. And then my sponsor walked me through that and showed me where my satisfaction was what it was about. It was me making amends to people just to get the pain out of me. And the side reward was to help other people that I had damaged. That was the side reward. My job was to get it out of me, get the poison out of there. That was my job. One of the things that bothered me all during my drinking, even prior to my beginning drinking, was I felt worthless, and I felt like I had no mission, no purpose, no nothing in life. And I thought the only people that had purpose were people that I couldn't stand. Like I couldn't stand religious fanatics standing on a corner handing out prayer tracts. I just hated that. I thought, is that what I'm going to be? I play drums. Am I going to be down in a corner playing drums for Salvation Army or something? And there's nothing wrong with that. But I couldn't do that. I was too proud and arrogant to do anything. I could never do that. I had to have some kind of purpose, and I had no purpose. I had no purpose except to abuse my family and to make everybody's life miserable and gratify myself. That's the only purpose I had. And you know that's not going to be sustaining. That's not going to keep you from sticking a pistol in your nose, you know. That's just not going to do it. And when I come in here, they told me something that's in that book. It's one of the most important things to my program. That is, we know, we can see where our experience can benefit others. And that's what we can do. Our experience can benefit others. And I don't think that now. I know that. I know it. There's been other alcoholics that shared with me that they identified with me, and they're all right because of you and me and them and all of us together. We share what we have, and it makes us better and keeps us better. What more lofty thing? And there's nothing to it. We already went to school for that. You know, we already got the bad. That's just like going through hell, graduating from Harvard or something, and just tearing a sheepskin up or something. Who would be stupid enough to do that? You go out on the streets and you wreck your cars and you puke on your parents and you maybe even beat your kids or you do some other crap and you find out that that's of some value. Why in the hell would anybody want to walk away from that? Why would I want to go back down on the street and hand out prayer tracts? I ain't a good prayer tract hander-outer. You know? It's better for me to go sit down with somebody that their life's coming apart like mine was and say, I know what you're going through, brother. This is what I went through. And tell them my story exactly the way it is. And if it don't help them, go grab somebody I think can help and bring them down there. Say, like that Chuck would say. Or the George that would sit beside Chuck, he'd say, you need to talk to Chuck, Jack. He knows more about that. You know, he knows more about it. He's got some kids. He knows what that's like. Or this guy would say, he knows. He'd been married. He knows what it is. You know, we're all together here. We're able to draw on each other. There's nothing you can't have in AA, nothing. All the things that I wanted when I was drinking, if I only had a nice car, if I only had a decent suit, if I only had this, I only had that. You can get anything you want in AA. And I know that for a fact because I wanted things. I've mentioned from the podium stuff I wanted. Christ, it would happen to me. You know, it's not God reaching out of the sky with lightning and fixing something for you. It's just that these people in here are all full of love. If you really want to do something in here, tell somebody. Just let the word out. Say, I want a boat. I want to ride around a boat. You keep bitching about somebody. Say, hey, come here. Jim has a boat. Get your ass down here on Saturday morning. And you'll be on a boat. But you might have to clean that son of a bitch before you go. You know, because MAAs, they're charitable, but they don't give nothing for nothing. You know? But if you really want something, you really think you want to dance, nobody, the girls won't dance with me. Go to an AA dancer, go up to them and tell them, not to dance with me. No. No, you're an AA, you got to dance with me. Jesus, I... Tell them the truth. They say, well, I don't like you. You're uglier than shit. You know? They say, well, if you had any humility, you'd dance with me anyhow. If they say, no way, you say, who's your sponsor? And then you go ask their sponsor. And if she won't do it, if she won't dance, would you turn her into our sponsor? You might have to dance with the sponsor's sponsor's sponsor. You might have to take her out of her goddamn wheelchair and dance. And at that point, you'll be learning something, see? Go find the ugliest woman you could find in a room and kiss her, goddammit. Because she needs it more than you do. Because you're not only ugly outside, you're ugly inside, too. So that's the way this program works. There's women in AA that dance with this bald-headed 61-year-old fat guy. And I don't care what they think about it. I don't want to, you know, scare any of them. But I think about it, I want to go out there and have a good time. I have no evil intentions. And the only time anybody refuses you something is when they're afraid of you. You know, especially everybody in AA, they got a good heart in here because they've been on that wreck ship. And they're tired of hurting and jockeying and manipulating around, trying to dance around life. They want to live in here. We all want to live. And we usually do, and we usually have a good time. That's why we're all crazy enough to pull a couple bucks together and pay Northwest Airlines to bring some other strange animal from a different land, you know, out to here. And I'm really grateful to be here. I've really enjoyed myself here. God bless every one of you.